MasterCard is working on fingerprint sensors embedded in credit cards because chip readers are just too slow. The Google Home speaker can now recognize up to 6 voices, but each of those voices can only be tied to one Google account. And Kendrick Lamar's new album, Damn, is built for the streaming music future. All this and more on Tech News Today right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1751, recorded Thursday, April 20th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one who has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we tell you the tech news and we tell you why it matters. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Nathan Olivares-Giles. And today's guest is Rolf Winkler from the Wall Street Journal.
Shall we get to the news?
Let's do it.
Okay. MasterCard is working on a fingerprint sensor that is built into your physical credit card or your debit card and will work with the chip to verify your in-person purchases. Engadget says MasterCard is currently testing the cards in South Africa and hopes to roll them out by the end of the year. Now, the card isn't any thicker than a normal credit card, and it will work with the current chip and PIN readers, so they don't have to come up with a different device to make it work, which has kind of been the problem with the chip and PIN readers, because, you know, nobody's chip works.
They're slow, they're wonky. Blah.
So I love Apple Pay. I use it wherever I can. I usually use it with my watch, so like nothing even comes out of my bag. I'm just, you know, tap and pay. And I like the idea of the fingerprint. That, you know, everyone will say the fingerprint is not as secure, people can hack it, but I think yes, anything, people can hack anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes, that is the truth. If it is digital, if it is out there on the internet or in your pocket, some sort of device, some sort of computer, it can be compromised in some way. So that's just the truth of using all of this stuff. But, you know, of the things that you have on your person that can be used for security, the fingerprint is probably one of the best because it's always with you. It is difficult to replicate, even though it is something that can be replicated. And hopefully the fingerprint sensing technology will get better over time so that it gets tougher and tougher to fake that sort of thing. But, you know, I guess this is kind of coming to a point where we have to really ask ourselves how much we trust each of these companies with some of our biometric information, right? So maybe you'll start with a fingerprint. Later, it will be a retinal scan, a face scan, all these different things that are kind of popping up. And where is it all going? And I do wonder how many things we need to have our fingerprints be recognized by. The chip reader stinks. It's terrible. Those things never work. Apple Pay and Android Pay and all that, Samsung Pay, so much faster, so much easier to use. But I kind of like the idea of just having one device that is the entry point to all these other things rather than like having a fingerprint sensor on everything I got.
Yeah, I don't like that. And the signature, I mean, using the signature is just bananas.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, every credit card company is probably going to hate me for saying this, but every time I have to put down my signature in any of those digital signature capture things, I just make scribbles. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to have copies of my signature so that they can do, you know, what with it. And maybe that's just me being like paranoid, skeptical journalist Nate, but you know, none of them check that. No one ever comes back and says, you drew a smiley face at Safeway, and then, you know, you drew like Slimer from Ghostbusters at the gas station, and like no one checks or cares. So it's like, why are you making me do this if you're not actually using it anyways, you know?
Yeah. ZDNet had a story about a card where the three-digit code on the back, because I feel like that three-digit code on the back used to be so private, but now you're giving it everywhere.
Every time I order pizza, they ask for it. And at first, I was like, do you really need it? And now I'm just like, whatever, here it is.
What is it? Tell me.
No, I'm not on the air here. Okay. It's private.
But ZDNet had a credit card that they were looking at that had a changeable three-digit code. So it would, you know, kind of like two-factor authentication. You know, it's just like you can only use it during that period of time.
See, that seems useful.
Mm-hmm. But expensive. Like to put it on everybody's credit card?
Yeah, we're moving from credit cards being plastic with a magnetic strip on the back to actually being a gadget in and of themselves. And I do also have concerns over just e-waste. I mean, if credit cards are kind of disposable things, and, you know, as if we don't have enough plastic in the environment as it is, but now we're putting more and more technology into them. Those usually need conductors, precious materials, you know, all sorts of stuff. So that's always a red flag for me. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have a voice-controlled speaker in your home, you know how impersonal it actually can be. Sure, it can talk back, but an Echo, a Google Home, they never really have an idea of who they're talking to. Well, that is until now, kind of. The Google Assistant built into the Google Home speaker can now recognize multiple different voices, up to six, and it can deliver specific information to the person it recognizes, like plane flight info or calendar entries. Now, the way that this works is that each voice has to be tied to a specific Google account, and unfortunately, it can only recognize one of your accounts at a time. So if you have multiple Google accounts, like most of us do, for work, for personal, you're going to have to make a choice here. So what do you think, Megan? Is this progress? I mean, it does kind of feel like we've been wanting distinctive voice recognition on this level from our voice control speakers for a while. But now that it's here, I feel like it's a little disappointing.
It feels a little disappointing, especially because you can't, you know, if you have a separate work and home Gmail account, you can't separate them. Like, I wish it would be able to hear, like, you know, tell the difference between my work voice and my home voice, which is, so I would like to do that because I do have a specific work voice and a specific home voice. But you know what else this would do is it would prevent Burger King or other creative marketers from, you know, reaching into our living rooms and activating our devices.
Great point.
Because unless your voice happens to sound exactly like the guy in the Burger King commercial, which I'm sure some people do.
Totally possible. What a bummer that would be. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that Google said is that they're going to be analyzing voices and making this distinction on the device itself. And that will take milliseconds, which sounds pretty great. And this is all happening through an over-the-air update via software. It's rolling out in the US right now, the UK next week, and other markets after that. But I do wonder how long it'll be before they upload that info into their cloud, start analyzing it. I mean, companies that want all of the data, and Google is definitely one of them, are going to want to analyze your voices and then maybe even be able to tell between your home voice and your work voice and when your kid's imitating you and, you know, all these different things, right?
Right. Well, that's the other thing. It can keep your kids from buying things accidentally or on purpose. I don't have a Google Home. We have four Amazon Echo devices.
Wow, you're all in on the Echo.
We have one Alexa and three Dots. Sorry for saying her name. And they're all connected to my account because one's in the kitchen and one's in the bedroom. And then my boys each have theirs, but they don't have a smartphone. Mm-hmm. So it has to be connected to my account. I love it. And, you know, none of us really use it to say what our calendar is or read our email or anything that is connected. You know, so specifically connected to an account like a Google account that we don't, you know, I don't really care that it doesn't recognize my voice. But I think I would like it if, you know, I spoke to it and it knew me and the things that I would ask. And then, you know, it recognized that if one of my boys asked to, you know, order a bunch of remote control planes.
Be like, nah.
Yeah, not you.
You ain't mom.
Exactly.
Sit down, son.
Right. Yes, I would like it to say that like that.
Nah.
Yes.
No fruit roll-ups for you. No, see, I mean, it's interesting because I have the Echo speakers. I have a Google Home. And I kind of regularly switch between the two, just trying to stay, you know, knowledgeable, you know, as a reporter and all that stuff. But the thing is that I don't really use them for much either. It's kind of checking the weather, sports scores. I really stick to my Sonos speakers because they just don't sound as good for me and my, you know, audio tastes. But I do wonder a little bit, you know, even if your voice is your password, if we are going to get to a point where we are sharing that sensitive information, there's going to be hiccups. There's going to be mistakes. There's going to be problems. You know, these things are natural, especially when they're building new technologies. And, you know, if you're like me and you just don't want to share some of that private information with anyone, then you can actually go into the settings account and you can decide whether or not you want to share personal info. And that could be even something like a calendar entry or whatever. But yeah, I think there's still a big question over the usefulness of it. I think there's still a novelty there, but to make it something that's indispensable and like that you need, I mean, my smartphone is still like my little digital best friend, you know, I can't live and work without it, but the voice control speakers haven't really gotten to that level for me yet.
Yeah, I know. I mean, most of what I use my Amazon Echo, I could probably do with my phone. It's a lot of listening to podcasts and news and weather. It's true. Yeah. But it's nice to have them, and, you know,
yeah,
looks good on my geek cred credenza.
Oh, that's important. You got to keep that geek cred credenza looking spiffy.
Exactly. Uber is often called a sharing economy business, but that's not technically accurate. There's not a whole lot of sharing going on. Toyota and others have now invested $45 million in a company called Getaround, whose business model does involve sharing your car with other people. Now, people are calling it the Airbnb for cars, and TechCrunch says the long game is for people to have instant access to driverless cars. Now, you used Zipcar before you recently bought your own car.
I did.
What are your thoughts of sharing versus owning when it comes to cars?
You know, I love cars. I'm you know, a big fan of them. But for the 5 years I had not owning a car, I loved using stuff like Zipcar. It's kind of great because you get to try out lots of different vehicles. They're all pretty new and usually taken care of pretty well. There's Enterprise. There's lots of different options out there. And, you know, if you're going to, it's a little different. There are some options where you can actually get into someone else's car and they can like lease it to people for the weekend or rent it or whatever you want to call it. That was a little different. It's a lot different getting into a car that you know is a rental. It's there for that purpose versus getting into someone's car and then it looks lived in. And, you know, the seat cover is theirs, you know, and, you know, the little air freshener. And it's just a different thing. You feel like you're in someone else's space. Mm-hmm. Don't like that as much because I think cars are a pretty personal thing. But yeah, I mean, this is definitely interesting news. I think it's smart for Toyota and, you know, GM and the like to invest in these sorts of things. If we do move to a system where we aren't owning cars, where we're just getting access to cars that are probably self-driving in the future when we need them, that would probably be better for most people. It'd be better for the environment. It would, you know, because a lot of the cars we have are just sitting there not being driven, right? Mm-hmm. On most days. So that would probably be a smarter way to go. But yeah, I do love to drive and I do like having my own stuff.
Yeah, I hate driving. I cannot wait till the driverless car.
You're happy to give that up, huh?
I'm really happy to give it up. And this sounds interesting. So you works with an app. You locate the car. This is Getaround. You reserve it and then you can even unlock it with the app. It's like a code or something to unlock it. There's nothing I love more than my Prius that I just walk up to and it unlocks. That is, I don't know why, but I'd like to get rid of all keys. This is not a new company, Getaround. It was founded in 2009, so it's been around for a while. Marissa Meyer, and Ashton Kutcher also investors in it. So
good to know. Ashton's got his money in lots of different places. Always interesting to see what that guy's up to. Well, Palmer Luckey, the co-founder of Oculus, is back, kind of. On Thursday, Luckey chastised the Washington Post for pointing out in a couple sentences in an article that he donated $100,000 to Donald Trump's presidential inauguration. The donations weren't made in his name directly. Instead, he made the donations through a company called Wings of Time, which he's listed as the sole owner of. The name makes reference to the classic RPG video game Chrono Trigger, which I gotta say I am a fan of. Luckey was the public face of Oculus, Facebook's VR company, until last year when it was discovered that he donated money to pro-Trump, anti-Hillary Clinton groups that made often offensive memes that even at times deviated from politics into straight-up troll-like attacks on people online who didn't share their viewpoints. In September, he apologized for making the donations. On March 30th, Facebook announced that he left the company, and now we're learning this. So I do kind of wonder where Luckey could go from here. This is... it's a really interesting and weird way to pop back up into the public sphere He is a bit of a public figure as being the face of Oculus for quite a while, although he's not in that role anymore. But clearly it seems like he has some political viewpoints that he believes are important and should be shared with the world. And he's trying to do that. This is just kind of a weird way to resurface, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If you compare what he already was found doing, which was not just donating to Trump's campaign, but donating to an organization that was purposely posting these things, these, you know, memes against Hillary Clinton, you know, just trash posting, just riling it up. And what he said was, you know, I enjoy that. Like, I enjoy getting people riled up. So giving $100,000 to the Trump inaugural celebration, that seems less offensive. I mean, everyone's allowed to have their opinion. I think it's interesting that he was hiding it, like going to great lengths to hide it. And I don't know if that was something that he was advised to do because he was part of Oculus, which was part of Facebook. But the way he hid it, like through these video game references, really reminds me of Ready Player One. And you read that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's already you can make many comparisons to, you know, from Palmer Luckey to the character that's in Ready Player One. And, you know, he himself talks about how he was inspired because I think the book came out when he was still doing the Kickstarter for Oculus.
Yep.
And, you know, if you haven't read it, I'm not giving any spoilers, but one of the main characters is this guy who creates virtual reality, and he has this maze where he hides everything, like behind so many video game references that, which is part of why it's such an interesting book to read, because any of us, you know, who are interested in that sort of thing get excited.
Yeah, it's a must read. If you're nerdy about VR, if you're interested in it, if you're curious about it, it's a fairly quick and easy read. Like, get to it and check it out.
Yeah, or wait for the movie if you want, but I don't think
so. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, next year, I think. Feels like it should already be out.
Yeah, right.
But so, you know, I don't want to get into what his views are. They are obviously different than mine. But yeah, I do wonder what he's going to do next and if he's just going to become this sort of recluse that I do hope that he makes an elaborate game that, like, someone, you know,
something
40 years from now when we're living in this dystopian world and we're all living in, you know, that someone has to figure it out. I hope that he does that.
Yeah, I got to say, you know, I think in the past I've interviewed Luckey, and he was always a really nice guy and a very, very interesting interview, in part because he was so raw and maybe so unfiltered and not necessarily as trained to, you know, keep his mouth shut and not say things. I mean, he was, for a journalist, that stuff is great because he's open and honest and fairly transparent with you back then and with me. But, you know, I think he's a smart fella, and, you know, I can't say that I necessarily share all of his viewpoints either, but, you know, to be someone of that stature who's made such a contribution to technology, it would be great to see him pivot into a mature way to share his viewpoints and things that he cares about with the world. You know, talking smack through tweets to your opponents and rivals and those who criticize you, I think is a bit childish and not really the way to go about it. Although you could argue that that's kind of what our president does on an almost daily basis. So maybe he's got the right idea, but, you know, it would be nice to see him kind of find a way to have the voice that it looks like he wants to have and put that out there. Now, whether or not you agree with it, that's a whole other subject, but there are people who can intelligently and intellectually share all sorts of different viewpoints. I'd like to see that happen rather than, but hey, you know, it's one day, it's a few tweets. We'll see where this all goes. But, you know, we do need more intellectual dialogue going back and forth. And it seems like a wasted opportunity to just blow it on some dumb tweets.
Mm-hmm. So Palmer, if you're listening to this now, you can either do as Nate says, which is do something mature and creative and changing the world, or do what I say and do this elaborate puzzle then give all your money away at the end. You decide.
Both sound pretty fun. Both sound pretty fun. But yeah, Palmer, if you're listening, shoot me a DM or whatever.
Yeah.
let's talk.
According to CNET, the Federal Trade Commission wants to remind Instagram influencers that they need to do a better job of disclosing when their posts are sponsored. Hashtags and a simple thanks, whoever just gave me this pair of tennis shoes, are not enough. The FTC sent letters to several internet celebrities who were cutting corners, and the FTC also spelled out what it means to have a monetary connection to a product, which could include a business or a family relationship, monetary payment, and even the gift of a free product. Public Citizen and the Center for Digital Democracy sent a complaint to the FTC that called out several celebrities who had not been disclosing their relationship with advertisers or sponsors, including Bella Thorne, David Beckham, Chris Pratt, and even Mark Wahlberg. So, you know, it's unclear if they're just working fast and they don't, you know, really know what the rules are. So it's nice that they spelled it out, especially the giving of free products, because celebrities have gotten free products all the time.
Yeah.
And so just getting used to the fact that, you know, if you post on Instagram about it, it's seen as, you know, oh, you're supporting this. And we need to know whether you're getting paid to do that or not.
Yeah. It's, you know, there have been clear rules on these sorts of things for a long, long time. To a certain extent, Instagram is a bit of the wild, wild west, YouTube, lots of other places, because we have people who are influencers, quote unquote, and they amass a following because they're really into makeup, or they're really into video games, or they're really into cooking, or whatever it might be, right? But there's really no excuse for someone like a David Beckham, or a Mark Wahlberg, or a Chris Pratt to be making these sorts of mistakes, because really they have a team. They have people who will go and get those deals for them. They will negotiate those deals. They will sign those deals. And it's all spelled out on how you should do this and how you go about it. So there's no excuse for that. But there are tons of people these days who can be found on Instagram especially, but YouTube, all these different places, that are just posting sponsored stuff all the time. And, you know, sometimes it's like, hey, thanks so-and-so for sending this over, but it's not always clearly marked an ad. You see the same thing in tweets. So I think it's good that the FTC is stepping in here, but it's tough because those people might not have contracts. It might just be someone sent it to me in the mail, and if I give them a shout-out, I'm going to get more stuff, so let's keep it going. So there's a lot of fingers to point here on the side of the companies that are sending the things and the side of the influencers and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's not just stars. I mean, you mentioned this too, who are influencers. Bloomberg says that there's a whole influencer economy. I mean, there's just like organizations, agencies that work around this. Bloomberg, the headline is, it's the influencer economy runs on hot tubs, selfies, and whey protein, apparently.
And if you, I mean, you know, let's be real. If you go to Instagram, you will see those combinations of things in the same post on a regular basis as well. So.
Yeah. And we should say also that this show is also sponsored by Burke Chat.
we wouldn't be here without Burke.
It's not really sponsored by Burke Chat. And I think that we do a pretty good job of calling out who our sponsors are. And I'm going to do that too. You're going to find out what happens when a security company accidentally on purpose exposes its clients online. But first, I want to tell you about one of our sponsors, and I want to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. If you are planning to buy a home or refinance the home you already have, the process of getting approved for a mortgage can be bananas. I know, because I just did it. You can find the perfect place, but then you have to find a mortgage broker. You have to make contact. You have to find a time to meet that meets your schedule and their schedule. And no, we can't do this week, and maybe we can do that next week. And then you wait. And in that time, that house that you wanted to buy might be bought by someone else. But with Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information and get a mortgage approval in just minutes. You can also trust them, which is no small feat when you're dealing with getting a mortgage. And you probably already know how important it is to work with someone who you can trust and who has your best interest in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Here's how it works. First, you share your information. Then you explore your options and customize an offer that works for you, something that makes the best sense for you and your financial situation, where you are, your job, all that stuff. Then you get approved online, you make an offer, and then you close your loan. It's that simple and it's that fast. That's why they call it Rocket Mortgage, because you get a rocket fast closing where you want, when you want. And if you're concerned about privacy and security, I am happy to tell you that Rocket Mortgage offers 24/7 security monitoring, bank level encryption, and industry leading privacy guidelines. So lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage, skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support.
Cybersecurity startup Tanium built its way to a $3.5 billion valuation with investments from top Silicon Valley VC firms by demoing its software working in a hospital that was one of its clients. But Tanium didn't have permission to make the demos it did. A company selling cybersecurity software was showing off customer information that it shouldn't have been in a not secure way. Rolf Winkler of the Wall Street Journal got the scoop on all this, and he joins us now. Rolf, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Nate, how you doing?
Great, great. So walk us through this. This is fascinating stuff. How'd you come across this story, and tell us exactly what Tanium did that is so wrong and controversial?
Well, here's what they do. Basically, Tanium has pretty cool technology, first of all, and they wanted a cool demo to show it off. And here's how this works. Basically, the way Tanium does is it can tell you everything that's running on across kind of the desktops on your network. If you want to know every instance of Windows you're running to know how much to pay for it, or what your current versions of Java are, or the antivirus software you're running, or whatever, Tanium uses its peer-to-peer technology to tell you this kind of stuff instantly, like 15 seconds. You can query its tool, and it'll just tell you every computer. Other solutions, you kind of had to, like, go pull information into a database, then you had to query the database, and sometimes that would take a day. It'd just be old information, and if you're getting attacked, that's just too slow. So the problem for Tanium almost was people believing that they could really do this, and so they said, yeah, no, really, our technology can do this, and they wanted to show it in a live customer environment. And the customer they chose was El Camino Hospital in Mountain View. The trouble is the hospital didn't know anything about it.
So really, I mean, it's kind of a tough spot for Tanium to be in a sense. Like, in order to fully understand how this works, you have to see it in a live environment. But all of its clients would have information that they don't want to share. So is this kind of a matter of, like, they just moved too fast and they should have slowed things down and asked permission and they maybe were overeager? Or was this basically there was no other way to pull this off other than break the rules kind of agreement?
Look, absolutely. They needed to ask for permission because at the end of the day, what they were showing off was a whole bunch of very sensitive information to many thousands of people. Probably they did this demo at least hundreds and hundreds of times. But what they're showing are computer names, sometimes logged in users associated with that computer. So if I'm a malicious hacker, it was very easy for me, for instance, to look at some of the logged in usernames that I saw in YouTube videos of this demo, and I could just find them on LinkedIn. And if I was a hacker, I could go contact them and I could say, hey, you know, I see that your laptop with this name has out of date Java software, and I need you to click on this link to fix it. That person might, because I know their laptop name, think I'm from their IT team. So, you know, you can imagine scenarios where most chief information security officers would never want this kind of information being viewed publicly by any means. Certainly not a hospital that's in a regulated industry. So, absolutely, they needed permission, but sure, the hospital probably never would have given it to them. So, there's a lot of problems here.
So they weren't the hospital says Tanium didn't have access to patient information. So we're not dealing necessarily with like HIPAA rules.
I'm not an expert on HIPAA, but no, look, there was no patient information that was available. I think being shown in any demos, definitely not. It was just like these are the names of the computers that various users are using, and this is the software they're running, et cetera. It looks like there were no breaches as a result of this. So it's almost, some people will say no harm, no foul. And the bigger question is kind of, well, just from an ethics perspective, and is this okay? Because you know what? In Silicon Valley, some reaction I got to my story was, well, yeah, I mean, kind of dumb, but tons of people do this, which gets to sort of the Mars and Venus conversation of, you know, a lot of normal people would say, are you kidding me? And a lot of kind of really ambitious Silicon Valley types would say, yeah, I mean, come on, this isn't that big a deal.
Mm-hmm. It definitely speaks to the differences on how to pull this sort of thing off, kind of almost cultural differences to a certain extent. Is the hospital pissed off about this, and are they still a client?
No, they're not still a client. Look, their statement, they said they were dismayed. That was the statement they gave us. This was the kind of thing where we found it. I contacted the hospital. They had no idea what I was talking about, and it took them a little time to figure it out. And then they said, yep, we didn't know anything about this. This is a problem. We're unhappy that Tanium did this.
Could they have just anonymized the data that they were showing? Is there something that they could have done, an extra layer to put on to allow them to get live data that didn't compromise the customer in the process?
Probably, but they didn't, which is the problem.
Yeah. So given that, like you said, in Silicon Valley, a lot of folks are saying, not a big deal. Of course, the hospital doesn't want any part of it anymore. What is this going to mean for this company? Is this going to be a detrimental thing? Is this going to hurt their ability to get new clients? Or is this the sort of thing that people are just going to kind of look over and say, hey, the stuff works. Now we know it works. Keep on going.
Good question. I think what's interesting about Tanium is the product, by all accounts I've heard, is pretty impressive. But the company itself is facing a lot of issues. Before this came out, there were revelations first reported by Bloomberg about, we should say, the prickly nature of the CEO. He admitted in a blog post after our story about how he's hard-edged. Basically, people are accusing the company of having a toxic culture, which they deny. But, you know, the stories we've heard are that he bullies employees, that they fired people for ahead of their stock options vesting, which they deny, to be fair. But there's just and tons of executives have left. Which is a very large, noticeable red flag here. So good technology, but a lot of management questions.
Awesome. Well, great reporting on this, Rolf. You know, we're pretty lucky to catch you because you're actually in a deadline situation. So we really appreciate you coming on. But there's one more thing, the thing that you're working on, I guess, right now, which is Elon Musk's company Neuralink, which wants to basically put technology into our brains that would allow us to work with AI to, you know, become smarter and more capable and all these sorts of things. You basically broke the news on this a couple weeks ago, and now there's a website and a Twitter account up. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, there's a website, a Twitter account, and Elon Musk gave comments to the explainer site Wait But Why, detailed comments, and there's a 36,000 word post on Wait But Why.
Wow.
That is up, that basically explains mostly brain science, but gets into what Neuralink hopes to do in more detail, more or less confirming a lot of what we already reported.
Well, you probably haven't had a chance to read through all of those words yet, but is there anything that's revelatory today that you can share with us?
Sure. Well, we know now, we knew Elon was going to take a leadership role here. We weren't positive he was going to be CEO. He is going to be CEO of this company. That means he's CEO of three very ambitious companies. Tesla wants to, what does Tesla want to do? You know, they want to mass market electric, very difficult. SpaceX wants to go to Mars. Neuralink, we have more details now. This is interesting. Neuralink basically wants to re-engineer language in this way. You know, the way Elon describes it in his comments to Wait But Why, gosh, I'm going to mess this up. He's much better at this than I am. You know, the way our brains are these incredible calculating machines, and speech and typing are these output mechanisms that we have that are actually kind of slow when you think about it. Imagine if you could put a computer interface directly in your brain, and then, Nate, you had a computer interface in your brain, and our brains could effectively speak to one another, but without language.
Wow.
If that makes
so
sense.
Like,
the interfaces would interface.
It's amazing.
That's the general idea. That's the far out idea. That's sort of like the SpaceX wants to go to Mars idea. The more near-term idea that he confirmed is we want to build brain interfaces to help with brain disease, some strokes, cancer lesions he mentioned. That's the first thing they want to do, right? With SpaceX, yeah, Mars is cool, but first we're going to build a really neat rocket company that's going to deliver satellites to space. There's a business model there. So with Neuralink, that's the idea first. We're going to build a business model. We're going to develop these neural interfaces to solve those brain conditions, and then eventually will follow through on these more ambitious goals.
Wow. Well, even their short-term goals seem ambitious and far off. Thank you so much, Rolf, for joining us and telling us all about this. Tell people where they can follow you and your work and find your coverage on all of these things and so much more.
Sure. I'm a reporter at The Journal. You can always read The Journal, and you can follow me on Twitter at Rolf Winkler.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon. You always have such great stories.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's feedback time. Jonathan wrote in about our story earlier this week about student online privacy. He says, I have been a teacher for over 16 years and have a master's in education technology. I work in Connecticut, and last year the state legislators passed a very strict student privacy protection law, which is currently limiting what we're able to use as instructors. The law requires each school district to obtain a privacy agreement with every site or program. The agreement must include language that gives us as a district the ability to request data deletion. While the intent of this is good, the ability to effectuate these agreements is proving very cumbersome for both us as a district and the software companies. I believe that privacy has to be taught, and students need skills on how to share and be safe more than prohibitive laws and regulations that hamper abilities to learn needed skills. So that is a great point, Jonathan. We didn't really cover that side of it, that yes, sometimes all of those Byzantine requirements can really get in the way. And so it's great always to hear about people who are working directly with the things that we're talking about. So I'm hopefully there will be a way to respect students' privacy and also be able to freely use the technology. And that's the problem with the Google's G Suite for Education. I mean, by and large, it's the easiest to use and the easiest to administrate. And so that is why it's used. So it's unfortunate that they're kind of playing a little fast and loose with how they treat kids' privacy.
Yeah, it's a balance, you know, and obviously they need to find their balance when it comes to this. But yeah, it's great to have feedback like this from people who are in the trenches and, you know, living with this stuff directly on a daily basis. Love getting that kind of feedback and insight that only y'all can offer. So
I also like that he taught me a word that I had to look up, effectuate.
Yeah.
That was a word that I had not ever heard or heard in a long time.
Kind of makes sense that an educator would pull that out, right? Well, TNT's fan of the day is John Riches, who says, this is hashtag how I watch TNT on my Nexus 7, making turkey salad sandwiches with Easter leftovers. That sounds pretty good to me. This was posted on April 18th, in case you're worried about how long those leftovers were lasting. And hopefully John is, obviously okay eating all that good stuff. So show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, as John did here. Post it to Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it.
And finally, tonight, Victor Luckerson from The Ringer writes today on how streaming has changed the record industry in terms of how they measure success. He specifically cites the changes in how Kendrick Lamar's label has changed their outlook since his last record and this one. Going platinum used to mean selling a million CDs or a million $10 downloads on iTunes, but now it means something different. Now, one album is equivalent to 1,500 on-demand streams. Luckerson also points out that in the era of being able to stream whatever we want, whenever we want, we move from artist to artist pretty quickly. He writes, this is a quote, all-consuming popularity is more fleeting than ever in the streaming era, but it's important that an artist as cerebral and experimental as Kendrick can still seize it. What do you think about this, Nate?
Well, I think the metric of 1,500 streams to one album purchase is BS, to be honest. I think it's a little silly. Now,
Do you think it's too much or too little?
I think it's too much. There is some math that the record industry is doing to basically pull out some financial things. And you know, when you used to spend $10 on an actual CD, or maybe 15 back in the day, it was $15 to $20 when I was in high school buying CDs like once a week or whatever, versus streaming someone's song, maybe just one or two of them, maybe not even finishing the song. That's what their math is about. That's industry stuff. And it's important, especially in these days when, you know, Drake a few weeks ago came out and set records on Apple Music and Spotify, and now Kendrick Lamar is coming out here and doing what he's doing. I think there's something that's a little more interesting to me as a music fan, as someone who's interested and cares about technology and culture, which is really that question of relevance and popularity. you used to be able to look at, okay, you know, did so-and-so go platinum and how long did it take? They sold 1 million albums. How long did it take? Now you're asking these questions about, you know, these streams. How many did they get in so long? There's this interesting back and forth that's happening in hip hop. And I think you'll start seeing it in other forms of pop music as well, where these artists at a certain level are almost keeping each other relevant in a way. Now, Kendrick Lamar is a very different kind of rapper than a Drake is, but they keep each other relevant by sometimes there's like subliminal messages in their lyrics. Are they going after each other? Are they digging, you know, and like they're releasing one song at a time. They're hyping up their album for months and months on end. The whole process of issuing singles and then having the culmination of an album is stretched out. So every aspect of it is changing. That's kind of what makes this Ringer article such a good read, is it's really looking beyond the numbers into the kind of 360-degree view on how these artists release their music. And in some ways, because they're having this conversation through music back and forth, they are keeping each other a bit relevant even when they don't have new stuff coming out, which makes sense given what, you know, how collaborative of an art form hip hop music is. You know, it's not just someone in a room by themselves making this music most of the time. There's usually, you know, guest appearances and producers, and it's always kind of an ensemble cast, kind of like jazz music was back in the day. So really interesting stuff. But yeah, the whole 1500 streams to one album purchase, I don't care about that number.
Well, is it a different between, like, is a stream on Apple Music that I'm paying for different than a stream on Spotify when I am not paying?
Oh, you know what? I don't know. Different companies have different agreements with record companies or some kind of some standards across services, but different artists can command different pay levels. Exclusivity factors into this and all sorts of things. That's why we are getting artists releasing their albums on Spotify or Apple Music or Tidal or whatever weeks before going other places, like Chance the Rapper did recently with Apple Music for his Coloring Book album, which he won a Grammy for. The first to win a Grammy for a digital-only album that had no physical release. So this is all kind of stuff that's changing all of the time. So I don't have a good answer for that. But I do know that different artists, depending on, you know, there's not a lot of artists who are at Kendrick Lamar's level of cultural relevance and popularity. So, you know, he might have a slightly different contractual agreement with some of these streaming services than others. You saw that a few years ago when Taylor Swift pulled off all her music from Spotify and then was claiming that Apple was treating people better from the business side. That's because not all artists are treated equally by all of these services.
Yeah, it's amazing how much has changed just in the last 2 years. That's why this article is really interesting, because Kendrick Lamar's last album was 2 years ago. And so this has been a really important 2 years. It was the launch of Apple Music, you know, Tidal, and, the, you know, Tidal was really the thing. And now, you know, it maybe isn't the thing, or maybe it is. What's interesting to me is I posted on Twitter about this. I was listening to NPR and they talked about the day that the Kendrick Lamar album dropped, and you know, they just sort of talked about its cultural significance. And you know, I'd heard of Kendrick Lamar, and I was like, you know, I'm gonna listen to that, like, because it seems like it's something that's important. It sounds interesting. He sounds interesting. So, you know, I opened up my phone and I downloaded it. I didn't, you know, that was all that I had to do. Would I have listened to that and then said, like, I'm gonna go to Borders and I'm gonna buy the CD because I might like it and I might not like it? And, you know, I never would.
Yeah, you're willing to take more of a chance because there's less of a barrier to entry and cost to you to do so, right?
So, yeah, I mean, and what he says also, that makes us more fickle, too. Like, I'll listen to that, but then there's something else. And also that the charts are very, they're like filter bubbles of themselves. And do they even matter anymore, is the question.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, I kind of think they don't. I mean, I'll give myself as an example. Now, granted, my tastes and my habits are maybe a bit old school these days, but when new albums come out, I usually download them to my phone because I don't want to kill my data plan, right? So I might listen to an album multiple times, but does that count as a stream or not? You know, the only time I'm really streaming is when I'm in my apartment, but as I'm driving to work or I'm, you know, on public transportation, I'm not streaming. That stuff is downloaded to my phone and it's technically might as well be offline.
Yeah.
Yep. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. And you can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv or leaving us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also hit us up on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
Share your thoughts on the stories we discuss in the TNT subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. And find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me about what you think about Kendrick Lamar's new album, which I like, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm also happy to talk Kendrick Lamar with you and with Megan. And I'm on Twitter at NateOG. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burke, for helping out in the studio and
Victor
for editing the show. And thank you for talking tech with us today. We will see you all tomorrow.
Who's editing?
Damn it.
Victor?
Is it Victor again?
Victor.
Is it? Okay, so let's say Victor and Tony. Victor. And then you'll use the one that
Patrick makes says sense. Victor.